This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Do you know what a sedimentary scientist does? If your answer was not much, well, you misheard me. Not sedentary, sedimentary. It's someone who pretty much digs in the dirt and looks for answers.
It's natural for us to want to understand where we came from, how the Earth has changed itself, but then also thinking about other places where life might be.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to a sedimentary scientist and geochemist who is searching for the origins of life on Earth in the Earth. We'll also spend an academic minute with plants who don't need any dirt at all. At least they didn't a few million years ago. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Think about a research scientist doing his job. The first picture that probably flashed to your mind was a sterile laboratory and someone with a white coat on. But sometimes when you're digging for answers, you have to do some real digging. That brings us to Dr. Christopher Junium. Dr. Junium is an assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University. He is also a sedimentary scientist and organic geochemist who looks at the sediments left on the Earth to find the origins of life on the Earth. As part of our astrobiology series, Dr. Christopher Junium is discussing the origins of life with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gastina.
Well, we use the chemical record preserved in ancient sediments. And so we find sediments anywhere on Earth, either from the deep sea or up on land. And we look at the chemistry of those sediments. And specifically thinking about what I do and the organic side is I'm interested in the specific molecules that are retained in those sediments and what they tell us about the ancient Earth.
What could some of those molecules potentially be?
Well, so they are the remnants of former life, in particular plankton from the ocean. So the initial most important pieces of the food chain. So all of life is dependent in the ocean upon plankton. They're called primary producers, and they're called primary for a reason. So they're photosynthetic organisms. They use the sun for their energy and mostly use carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to make their organic matter. And their molecules are preserved in these ancient sediments, and we access that record.
Obviously, we're talking about billions of years here, right?
Certainly billions of years in terms of like really getting at the compounds. In some cases, it's the more recent stuff that has things that remain that you can identify specifically, but they still have signatures of these things retained in the sediments that are billions of years old.
So if we think of it like there's an hourglass and that sand is falling, there's layers upon layers upon
exactly.
Layers of Earth. And within these layers, there are these different signatures that you're trying to identify.
Absolutely. That's right.
Wonderful. Well, of course, it doesn't stop there. Now we got to get down to the nitty gritty. Are you working in a laboratory? Do you go out in the field? Is it a combination of both? And how does that process work itself out?
Well, obviously, most of us get into geology because we like to go outside and we like to go into the field. And not to missell what we do, I mean, I go out into the field for sure. And that's a very, very important part of what we do. But that's actually, sadly, a very small percentage of what actually happens. And so there's a lot of lab work, but we all are always hoping and striving to get back out into the field. So most of my work is a combination of field and lab work.
And are the folks that are out in the field that are gathering the samples and the things that you bring back to look at, are they also sharing? I imagine the research is shared, but are other scientists also getting to look at this matter? Let's say, do you share what's coming out of the ground with other scientists so they can analyze it?
Absolutely. I work with a wide range of people who have a wide range of expertise. And while we're still all kind of attacking the same problems and understanding the evolution of the Earth's atmosphere and chemistry, they all come at it from different directions. And so they use different kinds of chemistry to reconstruct the ancient Earth.
Well, that's exactly what we're talking about right here, right? How did this ancient Earth, through these sediments, you talked about photosynthesis and plankton, eventually contribute to what we have now here on the Earth, which is an abundance of life.
Right.
So then the question is, because you're here in Albany to deliver a talk at RPI in Troy, New York, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, that has since passed, as people are hearing the interview now, but you're here to talk about the nitrogen cycle and the evolution of Earth's redox state, lessons from the Proterozoic. I want you to explain Proterozoic. I want you to explain Earth's redox state and the nitrogen cycle. I don't know which way you want to go with it,
right,
but let's make it as simple as we can.
Right. Well, so the time period, specifically the Proterozoic, is from 2.5 billion years ago till 540 million years ago. So really, when you think about it, it's a pretty significant time span in Earth's history compared, especially the way we break down other parts of geologic time. It's one of the longest time periods that we recognize.
And is this all done through carbon dating? I mean, how do you know how far back it goes?
It's not carbon dating. So carbon dating is really only, you can only push it back to about 50,000 years. Mm. Various other kinds of dating, radiometric dating techniques are used, uranium and lead. There's a suite of dating methods.
To figure it out.
Yeah. And I mean, it's hard in the sediments that old to get really precise dates. So the farther you go back, the error bars get a little bit bigger. But
is that because of decomposition?
No, just the quantity of material that's needed to get really, really tight.
So we're
dates.
Talking about small amounts that don't add up to a degree of certainty.
Exactly. So the uncertainty is large, and it has a lot to do with the fact that as you go farther back in time, there's simply fewer areas that have rocks of that age that we can access. So where we are right now is mostly Paleozoic, and you have lots of Devonian and Cambrian and Ordovician rocks in these areas, but these very, and so those are the, you know, 400, 300 million year range. And the very oldest rocks that we're looking at, very, very small areas of Earth's surface, select places retain these records. And so places like Australia, the northern part of Fennoscandia, so Arctic Russia near Norway and Finland. I mean, there's some specific places on Earth that we go to access these records.
Why do we go to these spots? What is unique about their geology that allows us to extract these 2.5 billion year old materials?
Right. Well, I mean, Australia is one place that's very special because it simply hasn't been rung through the tectonic process. So it hasn't been significantly metamorphosed and, compressed and shaken up by mountain building processes.
Interesting.
And so the core of the Australian continent is extremely, extremely old. And actually, its geologic record goes even farther back in time than sort of this 2.5 billion year time frame. So,
I mean, do you get as far as the age of the Earth?
Not myself, but I mean, obviously, people are interested in these kinds of rocks, and some of them come from Australia. Some of the oldest Earth materials, their zircons, come from certain parts of Australia. So Australia is one of these places that South Africa has some very old rocks that I don't specifically work with, but people do.
And what about in Sweden? You said Norway,
yeah,
and Sweden.
So those rocks up there were accessed from an intercontinental drilling program funded project that was looking at this very specific area, time interval from about 2.2 billion years ago to about 1.8 billion years ago.
And am I to assume that you're using these rocks from Norway and Sweden? That's what you're looking at?
Yes.
And did you go there to get them?
I did not go there to get them. And actually, that most of the sites are actually in Russia.
Ah, interesting.
So
when you look at what you're doing here, the impact obviously is huge. I mean, you're looking at the geological record. You're trying to understand the Earth and its various sediments and these various cycles that have gone on in the evolution of the Earth. What is the impact for the rest of us?
Well, what we're looking at in this particular time frame in these particular rocks is we're trying to understand how the amount of oxygen in Earth's atmosphere has changed through time. And obviously, oxygen is very important to us. As we are sitting here breathing oxygen in and breathing out CO2, it's the fundamental basis of our metabolism. And understanding that has just simple implications that, you know, it's natural for us to want to understand where we came from, how the Earth has changed itself, but then also thinking about other places where life might be and the astrobiology implications.
Go
well.
Further with that. What do you mean the astrobiology implications?
Astrobiology implications. Is there life elsewhere in the universe? What does that life look like? How would that life evolve? Is it similar to here or is it not? So if we understand the trajectory of Earth and how it has changed chemically, we can use those signatures from Earth's history to look at other places.
And even determine whether that life came from out there.
Well, that's one of the hypotheses that has been around for some time now. Did life come from Mars?
Mm.
Still to come, our conversation on the origins of life continues with Dr. Christopher Junium. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1144. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Christopher Junium, an assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University. Dr. Junium is a sedimentary scientist and organic geochemist and is discussing the origins of life with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina.
Let me ask you something very, what I would consider simplistic, but if you're looking at a rock or a piece of earth from this 2.1 to 2.3 billion year period, how does it differ in the way that it looks, its properties, than any rock we might find out there from the particular period we're in now?
In some ways, they're the kind of rocks that we want to look at. They don't really look any different than the ones you'd find here in Albany or out in central New York or elsewhere. We want them to be as unaltered as possible, so not they haven't been heated significantly, they haven't been deformed. That's why we go to these specific places. It's not just that the rocks are of the age that we want, but that they retain a lot of their original chemistry. And that's what's important.
You know, you say they haven't differentiated much. So when these scientists like yourself are out there looking, how do they recognize, how do they know where they're going to find these kinds of?
Well, so there's been a lot of work done over the years of people simply going out and mapping rocks and figuring out the ages. And you look at it and you can look at the various minerals that are in these rocks. You can maybe find some of these compounds. And these are clear indicators of whether this rock has been essentially cooked to the point where I can't do the kind of work that I need to do. But in this case, these rocks have not been. And that's why it's a great place to go.
Well, if you think about the nature of science, you know, it seeks to answer hypotheses or theories and test those theories and try to confirm them through observation. But oftentimes, as you're doing your scientific research, more questions come
Absolutely.
Up than the ones you're trying to answer. Can you talk a little bit about that in your work?
Well, so the hypothesis that we're essentially testing is what caused the rise of oxygen, and then how did that proceed? How did the Earth respond? How did life respond to oxygen being added to the atmosphere? And so the idea is that cyanobacteria, so very simple plankton, they perform photosynthesis, eventually figured out quite novelly how to use water to make sugar from carbon dioxide. So rather than getting hydrogen and oxygen from, say, some organic molecule or hydrogen itself, they took their medium, the fluid they were living in complete abundance, and broke that apart to add the hydrogen to the carbon to make sugar, and the residual was oxygen.
Is that when we see it explode in the atmosphere? Is in that proterozoic?
Right at what is called the Archean proterozoic boundary. And one of the ideas in the past was that oxygen rose very rapidly well below the limits of current life, but enough that it impacted Earth significantly.
It was the start of some evolution there then.
Right. Well, the evolution is the origination of that process. And then everybody else, all of the other organisms, all the other kinds of bacteria need to deal with what was essentially a poison.
Interesting. So here we see the chemistry of literally the chemistry of the Earth changing. Is this a cycle thing? In other words, do we see once that oxygen rose, it continued to rise? Did it fluctuate? What happened here?
The old idea was that it rose to a certain level and it kind of stayed the same for actually most of the Proterozoic. And then at the end of the Proterozoic, it came up to sort of near modern levels.
So again, we're talking billions of years.
Billions of years. But a lot of the new ideas that are coming out, so people are testing, did it really just step up? Or is it more gradual? Did it oscillate? The Earth system tends to oscillate.
Because of changing temperatures, right? And,
temperatures
and that chemistry experiments
and
that going on.
And feedbacks associated with just oxygen is consumed by a range of processes that are actually ultimately controlled by tectonics in some respect.
And could an example be, you know, if there's exploding volcanoes, it could create an ice age and it cools down.
Right.
And then the billions of years, the cycle goes through, it heats up again.
Yep.
These
kinds
of things.
There are a lot of things of the way that the Earth doesn't normally just go up to one state and remain. It will go up to that state and it will overshoot and then come back down and kind of eventually settle on a steady state. But through this time period, the idea was that oxygen had just sort of risen to about 1% of the present atmospheric concentration of oxygen. And it looks like that now that it was a very gradually rising over a period of about 500 million years. And looking at the impacts of that small amount of oxygen in the atmosphere and how all of the other cycles rearrange. So oxygen, you know, it's not in a vacuum. All of the other important biological cycles, nitrogen, phosphorus, carbon cycles, you know, the pieces of life are respondent to oxygen specifically. And it was that rise in oxygen. It was this stepwise, secular, unidirectional change in the composition of the atmosphere where everything else had to rearrange because of the chemistry that's being introduced.
And I've seen some recent stories and reports on scientists who are working to replicate some of this in its entirety in the lab, which is very hard to do, to account for all of these different impinging forces. And if we can do that, then we have a much better model, I guess, for understanding what's happening.
Absolutely. I mean, we need to come at this from as many different directions as possible. So we look at the geologic record. People look at models. So mathematical modeling is a big piece in this. And then specific directed experiments in the laboratory. All of these are things that we need to fill in the gaps because we don't have a continuous full geologic record where we can look at multiple sites and say, okay, this is really what's happening. We have little pieces here and there, and we have to pull it all together and fill in the gaps with what we can do here today.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it? We're missing that essential information to answer this huge question.
Right.
And so we have to fill it in
with
our theories.
Right.
So let me ask you this, because we often hear about these extinction level events, an asteroid hitting the Earth that comes in and causes, you know, massive extinction, or at least wipes out a portion of the population. But this is something geologists can discover directly through looking at these sediments,
absolutely,
can't we?
Well, that's how we know that these things happened.
And what we find is there's a layer of sediment that's global in scope, right? So we know that this was a gigantic event.
Yes.
And do you and other scientists have a sense that this can easily happen again?
Well, it's pretty clear that, you know, we have an impact rate and we're being impacted with debris from space right now. And there is a distribution of the size of those things that hit the Earth. And eventually something very, very large will hit. Now, if we're thinking about the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction, the impact that killed the dinosaurs and a lot of other things, it had not just to do with the size of the impactor. It had to do with what it hit.
And it hit in the Yucatan, correct?
It hit in the Yucatan, and so it hit the specific kinds of rocks that it hit were calcium carbonate reefs. So you had a lot of carbonate, and then you had a lot of gypsum, which is calcium sulfate.
And does that create a larger impact? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not that the impact itself. It's that the fallout from that. And so there was large amounts of CO2 added to the atmosphere. There was, specifically with the sulfate, that created essentially sulfuric acid rain. And all of these things work together that, you know, if you live on the surface, it's really not a good place to be. But it also impacted the surface ocean through acidification. And so there's a wide range of things that it's not just impacts, because there have been plenty of impacts, and we have record of these in Earth history, and they don't always cause mass extinction. There's normally a little bit more to it, and mass extinctions are still a big area of research. And
absolutely.
The absolute triggers are not something that we entirely understand.
And I guess that's where I'll go with my final question scientifically for you, which is where this field is going. I mean, we've seen an explosion of technology in, you know, the last 30 to 50 years, and it seems to be exponential in nature. And you are studying these cycles and the evolutions. I mean, how close do you think we are to an understanding? Do you think, will we never come up with these answers? Is this something that we will be able to come up with? I mean, are you optimistic?
Well, I mean, as the technology that we have advances, our ability to make finer and finer scale measurements will hopefully come to some realization with some of these events where, I mean, you look at the evolution of our field and people think they rest on an idea and they're like, okay, this is good. And most people generally agree, but then someone thinks about it in a different way and starts looking at it again and, you know, comes back and you're like, oh, well, maybe I didn't understand that event in the way that we thought 10, 20 years ago. And so I think that, you know, we're just going to keep honing these events and trying to understand the mechanism. So the mechanism of extinctions, how oxygen rose on the surface of the Earth, or, you know, as we look forward, what are the impacts of anthropogenic CO2? And we use the geologic record to calibrate that. And so there are some specific intervals that seem to be good analogs. They're certainly not perfect because they're not today. But we need to use these places to kind of reconstruct Earth history. And we're often always looking either to other planets or to, you know, the future and what that may hold.
Dr. Christopher Junium is a sedimentary scientist and organic geochemist and an assistant professor in the Department of Earth Sciences at Syracuse University. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gastina. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, in partnership with the University at Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all the topics in our astrobiology series online at origins.rpi.edu. Finding evidence of life on Earth in soil is one thing, but on early Earth, some plants thrived before there even was soil. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. You don't have to be an expert gardener to understand a plant's need for fertile soil. But that hasn't always been the case. Katie Field, postdoctoral research associate at the University of Sheffield, explains how early plants survived on a planet that didn't yet have dirt.
Many obstacles faced the first plants that moved from an aquatic to terrestrial existence more than 450 million years ago. One of the most significant challenges was the land itself onto which they were emerging. Earth's land masses were little more than bare rock, with many growth essential nutrients locked away within minerals. The first plants didn't have roots, so how did these land colonizers get at the nutrients and become the super successful and diverse kingdom that we're familiar with today? Our research sheds new light on the importance of the role of fungi during the greening of the Earth. The ancient fungi that we study are excellent extractors of nutrients from rocks. By partnering up with these fungi, the earliest plants stood a much better chance at life on land. However, it wasn't a simple giveaway on the part of the fungus. How did they gain enough carbon to satisfy their appetite? The answer lay in plants' ability to turn atmospheric carbon dioxide, or CO2, which was well over three times the concentration of today, into sugars through photosynthesis. By exchanging sugar for nutrients, a mutually beneficial relationship was formed. We wanted to know how plant fungal symbiosis has functioned over evolutionary time, alongside the fall in atmospheric CO2 concentration. Our study used representative species of the most primitive plants through to modern-day garden weeds and measured the efficiency of the carbon-for-nutrient exchange. We showed that under a high prehistoric CO2 atmosphere, symbiosis was most efficient in the primitive plants, while under a modern-day CO2 atmosphere, the modern weeds fared better. These findings suggest that as CO2 fell, plants evolved roots and leaves which powered a more efficient exchange of carbon-for-nutrients with their fungal partners. This put them at an evolutionary advantage, leading to the further diversification into the wonderfully varied ecosystems that we're familiar with today.
That was Katie Field of the University of Sheffield. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.